Welcome to Enriched Menopause, where perimenopausal and menopausal women can learn what's going on with their bodies and how to thrive during this stage and beyond. You are not crazy and you are not alone. I'm Dr. Jessica Rich. Let's do this together. Hello and welcome back to Enriched Menopause. I've got a wonderful guest with me here today, Dr. Aviva Hopkins, who is a rheumatologist and recently made the transition to concierge medicine. Dr. Hopkins, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much.
I'm so happy to have you here today because rheumatology, I feel like, is one of those, what I consider very complicated fields where there's so much to sort through. So tell us about your background and how you got interested in rheumatology.
I actually, as you said, I just made this transition to concierge medicine and rheumatology, and I'd been practicing at Holy Cross in Fort Lauderdale for 10 years and now have moved my practice to Hollywood. But it's funny, I know many people think of the world of rheumatology as a big mystery and scary, but I don't know. For me, I like the challenge and sort of deep diving into people's issues and figuring things out. I think that's actually what makes rheumatology so exciting and engaging. And also being able to have long-term relationships with my patients is really what makes it so great and rewarding as well. Patients sometimes come to me with symptoms that they've had for many years that no one's been able to figure out. And, you know, we have to talk through all the symptoms and put that together with the labs and their exam and then, you know, imaging as well often and come to an answer.
So I know you treat patients of all ages and genders, but of course, with this podcast, we are focusing on perimenopause and menopause. So for women in their like 40s to 60s and beyond, what are some of the most common issues you see in that group?
Well, I guess I'll start with the concept of arthritis, you know, because people throw around that term and they say, well, I have arthritis. Well, you know, it's a really very general and non-specific term. And I like to say, I like to break that into two pieces where there's the wear and tear kind of arthritis, and then there's the autoimmune inflammatory type arthritis. And so, you know, obviously wear and tear arthritis, you know, starts to happen in patients who are 40s, 50s, and even more so after menopause. In terms of the more autoimmune inflammatory type arthritides, you know, rheumatoid arthritis really affects people in their 40s. You know, that's sort of the peak age of onset, but really, you know, rheumatoid arthritis can happen anywhere from 30s to 50s, and obviously later too, but that's sort of the peak age. And Sjogren's disease also is a greater prevalence in patients who are 40s to 60s. And also another disease that's sort of maybe under-recognized in women and happens later in menopause, I would say, is gout. You know, you'll see that more in patients who are in their mid-60s to early 70s. We sort of forget that population.
Let's talk about each of those a little bit, because of course you talked about the differences in arthritis. And I've had an episode previously with an orthopedist where we talked about how certain joint pains can occur in perimenopause and menopause, related a bit to estrogen as well. So how does someone determine like what's osteoarthritis, that wear and tear arthritis, what's rheumatoid arthritis, what's, you know, joint pain that's not related to arthritis? Like, how do you go about evaluating that?
Right. So, you know, that's basically when someone's coming in, my main goal is to sort of figure out, is this sort of the wear and tear variety versus something, you know, in more of an autoimmune type flavor. And so the big questions that I'm focused on, for example, morning stiffness. Morning stiffness is really one of my very important questions, because morning stiffness, 30, 45 minutes or longer, that's, you know, concerning. Whereas if someone's stiff, you know, oh yeah, sometimes patients will come in, oh, doc, I'm so stiff. It lasts how long? 5 minutes. You know, that's more in the world of osteoarthritis, the wear and tear kind of arthritis. Mm-hmm. But when patients are stiff in the morning for 30, 45 minutes or longer, if they sit down, if it comes back again, you know, more prolonged, that's something that's very concerning to me. You know, it depends also what other issues are going on. You know, do they have any other unexplained symptoms? Like all they were previously well and feeling good, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're fatigued or having rashes or, you know, having some skin, you know, other sort of skin issues, you know, maybe recurrent fevers. These are things that would make me think that something else, you know, potentially autoimmune is going on.
So if it is more that kind of autoimmune or looking at rheumatoid arthritis, you go by the symptoms, of course, and kind of putting the pieces together. But is there other testing that can help you with that diagnosis?
So there are definitely tests. And it's also the exam, because we want to see if they have, you know, which joints are involved, because certain joints, like at the base of the thumb, that's more common for wear and tear kinds of arthritis, where other joints in the hands may be more suggestive of autoimmune. So you have to take the patient's symptoms, you have to take their exam, and then you also put in the piece of the blood test. So we always look at markers of inflammation. And I wish I could say that that's foolproof, but unfortunately not. Sometimes markers of inflammation are normal, but in some cases they are elevated, so that can be meaningful. Also, the two blood tests that exist for the two basic blood tests that exist for rheumatoid arthritis is the rheumatoid factor and the CCP antibody. So those can give information as well. But there are patients who have seronegative rheumatoid arthritis, for example, where the blood tests are negative, and that can happen in 30% of the population. And so it's not always so clear cut that, oh, no, the blood tests are negative, no, you don't have rheumatoid arthritis. No, you can have blood test negative rheumatoid arthritis. So that's why putting the whole picture together matters. And then in psoriatic arthritis, for example, very often the markers of inflammation are negative and there's no blood test to make that diagnosis. So it's really, we really heavily rely upon what symptoms they have.
Yeah. And I think it's so important to put that picture together. Everybody wants to have like that one test that says, yes, I have this, or no, I don't have this. And oftentimes that just doesn't exist. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
It creates uncertainty for sure. But that's why it's so important to get a good history.
And so say you've put together the picture, you've diagnosed somebody, they have rheumatoid arthritis. What kinds of treatments? And I know it's going to be individualized, but you know, can you give us a little bit of like the general categories of how you would go about treating that?
Specifically in the world of rheumatoid arthritis, sort of the mainstay, the anchor drug that we use is methotrexate. But thankfully, actually through the years, I mean, there's really been an explosion of new medications that exist to treat rheumatoid arthritis, many biologics and other advanced therapies. And we are living in an age where, you know, many of my patients, they're on these medications and people have no idea that they have rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis. You can't tell. They're living normal lives. They're functioning. Yes, they have to take medicines, see us, you know, a physician regularly, but they're not, you know, impacted in a meaningful way where people would even necessarily be able to notice.
Right. So definitely a treatable, but long-term treatable type of condition.
Yes. These are chronic conditions that do require chronic treatment. Yes, that is true. That is true.
And you mentioned Sjogren's syndrome, which I have a feeling people listening, if they don't have it themselves or have somebody close to them that has it, they've probably never heard about it. So tell me a little bit more about Sjogren's syndrome, like what it is, how you diagnose it.
So it's a syndrome that's associated with dry eyes, dry mouth. There can also be vaginal dryness, dryness of the skin. And the thing, and that also can be associated with fatigue. The difficulty with Sjogren's is a lot of these symptoms can, you know, everything that I just said can happen with menopause. Mm-hmm. And there are blood tests that we usually like to be positive, the Sjogren's antibodies. And there's another test that maybe is getting more traction, the early Sjogren's panel that I like to use as well. You know, the ophthalmologist can help get involved by measuring, you know, tear production, like with a certain test, and biopsies can be done, and lacrimal gland biopsies, but that's more in the weeds, I would say. But, you know, often we unfortunately, and it's one of these diagnoses that it can be very impactful and there's no specific clinical treatment, but we sort of borrow from our other conditions. And a lot of us, you know, use our clinical judgment plus labs to make the diagnosis.
I know for my patients who have Sjogren's, it's always a lot harder to treat their vaginal dryness because we can do it, but it may take a little bit more than the typical menopausal vaginal dryness. And for some, that may be the tip off that they do have Sjogren's, although most of the time they've got the diagnosis before I'm seeing them for that.
They have dryness in multiple areas. So it's not just a vaginal dryness. It's also like they have that sandy, gritty sensation in their eyes, you know, dry mouth, like cottony, you know, difficulty swallowing things, maybe without having liquids. I mean, those are more severe, but it can be more mild too.
Okay, so always important if you're feeling those sensations to have it worked up, preferably by a rheumatologist like you who knows what to look for and knows how to kind of put those pieces together. And definitely for my patients who are not really responding to our treatment of vaginal dryness, I always ask, you know, if there's dryness other places, and we kind of, you know, start a workup there.
Sometimes the ophthalmologist will sort of, you know, start these questions when there's the dry eyes. You know, obviously you're dealing with vaginal dryness. So yes, somehow they get funneled to a rheumatologist, you know, when all of a sudden they say, oh, there's dryness here, dryness there, you know, multiple areas, it kind of brings up the issue.
You also mentioned gout and that it often gets forgotten. And definitely, you know, I think of gout as that, like, usually, you know, makes me think of like an old, you know, king who's eating very like rich foods and lots of alcohol. And I typically think of a man when I'm picturing a patient with gout, but tell me, you know, what you're seeing with women and gout.
So it's much less common in women. That's the truth of it. But it does start to happen to women who are older, you know, in their mid to late 60s. That's when it can happen. So it's not common, but it can happen postmenopausally.
And tell us a little bit more about, you know, what is gout? What would somebody present with?
The most sort of classic presentation is, you know, a sudden onset of redness, pain, swelling of a big toe or part of their foot or their knee. And really it's extremely painful, like even hurts to have a sheet on it. You know, very often it's confused with it can look like an infection, like a skin infection, cellulitis, to the untrained eye, because sometimes it's just so red and painful. That's sort of the most classic presentation.
Mm-hmm. So a lot more redness and swelling, and usually more like one joint as opposed to the arthritis, which are often going to affect more joints and maybe not have all the redness associated with it.
Right. Like, so usually, you know, an autoimmune inflammatory arthritis like rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis is going to affect multiple joints. One joint maybe makes me think wear and tear, mechanical issue, and multiple joint involvements that happen suddenly is more autoimmune inflammatory arthritis. And a big red swollen toe joint makes you think gout.
So these are kind of some of the specific diagnoses you see. I would say, like, in a lot of the women I see, it's a little bit less clear. So they can have these kind of generalized symptoms, like some general malaise or just not feeling well. And maybe they've seen their primary or a rheumatologist and had some testing done, and maybe they have an elevated ANA. And a lot of the symptoms can overlap with other perimenopausal or menopausal symptoms, but it can be a little bit unclear sometimes if there is some sort of autoimmune condition going on. So what do you do with someone like that?
So the positive ANA is sort of the most, it's a very common referral, and it can be very concerning and scary for patients. So the first thing you have to look at is how high is it? So an ANA of 1 to 40, 1 to 80 is actually considered a low positive and may not be clinically meaningful, because 10% of the population actually can have a positive ANA without actually having a disease. And, you know, if someone has fatigue and a low positive ANA, they might think, well, that's the reason, you know, oh, I have an autoimmune disease, but it's not necessarily the situation. That's why you really have to talk about, you have to start asking about all the different organ systems. You know, you start putting it together. Well, are they having hair loss? Are they having Raynaud's, which means color changes of the, you know, fingertips or toes, blue, purple, white, in cold temperatures? Are they having any rashes? Are they having any unexplained fevers? You know, are they having any joint pains? You kind of have to put the whole story together, plus the labs. When the ANA is higher, that gives sort of more credence that something autoimmune is going on, but not always. You have to put everything together. And sometimes people just have, this is sort of where things in rheumatology get tricky, and the mystery of, well, who has an autoimmune, who doesn't? Because sometimes these things have not fully presented themselves. And this is where, for people who have a family history of autoimmune disease, taking care of yourself is so important, like having good dental health and not smoking, being careful with your diet. These things are very important.
I love that you bring that up, because that's always the question I have too, because many times we think, okay, we have a family history of this, there's nothing we can do about it. But are there things that women can do for prevention of autoimmune disease?
Definitely, like I said, good dental health, preventing periodontal disease, please floss, you know, take care of your teeth. Mm-hmm. I always say also be careful about sunburns. They sort of stimulate the immune system. So really try, you know, wear sunscreen and don't get sunburns. Achieving and maintaining a healthy weight and exercise is so important. And I would say this might interest people the most is that actually there was an article in the British Medical Journal in 2022 that actually showed vitamin D and omega-3 fatty acid supplementation for 5 years resulted in a reduction of autoimmune disease by 22%. So people really like to know about what they can do in terms of supplements. No one likes the hard work of diet and exercise, but there's many ways to good health, everything, you know, diet and exercise and some supplements and depending, you know, on each situation, but taking care of your dental hygiene, all of these things are important.
Right. Of course. And this comes up so often on the podcast and I always say, it doesn't matter what area we're talking about. It's always like, you can't get away from like good diet, exercise, sleep. But I do like that you add in that vitamin D and omega-3s can be helpful. And those can help with a lot of different inflammatory conditions. And more we're finding that, you know, what we think is adequate vitamin D is not quite enough. So supplementing there can be helpful. Are there any other tips that you'd like to leave us with or anything that you wish women knew when they were going through this transition?
Well, you know, this transition is also, you know, we didn't talk about the big box osteoporosis. So, you know, as women hit menopause, the cells that break down bone work faster than the ones that build bone. And over time, that leads to bone loss. That's also why it's very important to stay strong and flexible, you know, to reduce risk of injury and falls, you know, incorporate exercise into your daily activities, not just obviously, you know, doing an exercise class or working with a trainer are great, but hey, park farther away, take the stairs.
Little things that you can do throughout your day to be more active, get more exercise. And you're right, but osteoporosis is a whole nother big box. It's a whole nother episode. I actually do have another episode on osteoporosis. So refer back to that because yeah, we could talk on and on about osteoporosis. But sure. I think that this has been really helpful to kind of talk about some of these other inflammatory and autoimmune conditions. So I really, really appreciate it. Aviva, if people are looking for you, where can they find you?
So my new practice, Concierge MD, where I'm doing concierge rheumatology and internal medicine, is in Hollywood, Florida. And our website is conciergemdfl.com.
Excellent. We will link to that in the show notes. And of course, you're right down the road from me in my practice now. So that makes it very convenient for my patients. So nice talking with you, Dr. Aviva Hopkins. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast, leave us a review, and share with someone in your life who may benefit from this too. Remember that while I am a doctor, this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is for informational purposes only. Talk with your doctor about what may apply to you and your health. We'll see you on the next episode of Enrich Menopause.